Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Nancy Roth. We're beginning a week of readings from Shorty's Yarns, The Cowboy Tales of Bruce Kiskaden. His cowboy poetry is still wildly popular and performed in the circles of that popular art form. But the stories lay buried until Bill Seams found one of them in a library volume of an old Western livestock journal. Further diligent research resulted in a beautifully produced book, Shorty's Yarns, published by the Utah State University Press. It includes many of the excellent pen and ink drawings by Catherine Field that originally accompanied the poems and stories, as well as a great deal of biographical material on Kiskaden. Bill will give you a taste of that following tonight's story. The Western Livestock Journal is still in publication. Its March 1st issue sadly including a story on the devastating effect of the 2019 winter weather on Washington dairy cows. But now let's cheer ourselves up with Shorty's Yarns.
Speaking of Bill, the first time I ever see him was in a little mountain town up in Colorado when we was both a heap younger than what we are now. I was looking into a mirror, which same don't give no favorable opinion of myself. So I takes to looking at a large picture on the wall. It was a large lady in Mae West clothes, and she is sitting by a table and holding up a big glass of beer. There was a picture of a goat mixed up in the affair, but things was sort of hazy at the time, and time ain't improved things none as regards the goat. I hears argument at the other end of the bar, and a feller is saying that this here country is so mountainous that there ain't no room to do nothing. Then I hear Bill say, "You're sure wrong there. This country's stood up on end like, and you got four sides and the top to use, whereas in a level country you only got the top. And as for it being rough, I mostly been able to get what I went after around here." "Yeah," says the other feller, "and leave most of your clothes and a lot of your hide on the brush." "Clothes don't make the man," says Bill. "No, but they go a long ways towards keeping them from freezing to death in the winters they got up in these parts," says the other feller. Well, I goes out and forks my hoss and starts up to where I'm working, and who catches up to me but Bill, and we get right friendly. About 3 miles up the creek, we find a hand that has been throwed and kicked in the head, and his brains is oozing out. We finds his hoss, and there's a big spur track across the saddle, so we figure it's an accident. We goes back to town and gets a buckboard and the doctor. When the doctor gets there and looks at the feller and says, "That's his brains." "Sure is," I says. "Can you two fellers swear that this man was a cowpuncher?" asks the doctor. Bill says, "He can," and I remarks that he was in a work I was on about 2 weeks ago. The doctor takes our names and hightails it for town and don't wait for nothing. About 2 months later, Bill and me is in town, and we meet this doctor, and he won't have nothing to do with us. So after a few drinks, we goes up to him and tells him to name what he's sore about. "Well," says he, "you mind that feller we found up on the South Fork of the creek with his brains kicked out?" Well, I went and reported to the medical world that I had made the amazing discovery that a cowpuncher had brains, and give you two rannies for witnesses. They wrote to some of the natives here, and them natives wrote back that you two fellers was the biggest liars in these parts. And so, my amazing discovery won't go down in history. There's a heap more I can tell you about Bill, but we ain't got no more room here on account of paper only having two sides. Bill's engine trouble. Now, this is engine, you know, engine, Indian. Ted Hensel's always saying that the Spokane people call themselves engines. And so, anyway, this uses the word engine. Bill's engine trouble. There is one engine affair that ain't never got into print as I know of, but I know it happened because I was there and done seen it. Yes, it was my old friend Bill that I have mentioned before in the columns of this here cow paper. I hadn't seen Bill for a spell, having been down in the lower country, but I was like Betsy from Pike in the old song. I was full of that strong alkali. So I drug it for the high country again, where there was good water and lots of work in the summertime. I got into the little mountain town where we used to hold out and says hello to the bartender and sort of relaxes, as folks says these times, and takes to waiting for Bill between drinks. Well, I'm in a friendly frame of mind when I see Bill coming. He's riding a raw bronc that you can just about turn with the hackamore. I don't rush out to meet him like some politician, this not being good manners in them parts. He knows where I'll be if I'm in town, so he looks for a place to tie. I ought to gone out and let him tie onto my saddle horn, but I was in a state of mind where a feller overlooks any trifling matters. Bill can't tie to no porch posts, for the bronc might set back and bust 'em, and there is a few old buggy and wagon teams tied to the only two hitching racks in town. And if the bronc tears down a rack, it's going to bust up things bad. Bill don't think to go and turn him in the corral back of the livery stable, but he gets one of his big ideas. Next to the saloon is a pool room with a cigar stand, and out on the board porch is a cigar statue of an Injun. In one hand, he's holding out a bunch of cigars, and in the other, a tomahawk all raised like he's going to knock you in the head. I sort of figured he was supposed to be just daring any feller to try and swipe his terbacker. This Injun chief is stood up on a high pedestal that has rollers under it like one of them fancy bedsteads. I see right off that Bill has got a couple of drinks someplace before he lit in town, for he has that look he always had when he didn't care a cuss for nothing. He looks the layout over, and then he cheeks the bronc and gets down and gets his hoss as close as he can to the cigar engine and ties his rope right around the middle. Then he comes up to where I am, and we cuss each other out right friendly and go inside and take a few and find out what we've been doing for the last year and then some. We're just at the point where Bill tells me about how a married woman that I admired a heap is now divorced and living happy ever after, when the citizen that runs the cigar place busts into the bar room and starts to throw sand on Bill's back about that hoss being tied to that cigar statue. Being in a peaceful humor, me and Bill starts out to move the hoss, but this here peevish cuss gets in front of us, and to make a showin', he rushes over and sort of points his finger at the bronc. Well, the hoss jumps back and jerks the rope, and that Injun chief on the rolling pedestal goes right towards him. And the bronc don't know whether the Injun aims to feed him tobacco or brain him with the tomahawk, but he ain't waiting to see. There's been some talk about who led Geronimo out of Mexico, but there was no doubt about who led this Injun out from there. It was Bill's hoss. He sure went from there running and kicking, the cigar statue following about 3 feet behind when it ain't swinging in circles. The pedestal busted loose first, and then the arms, legs, and tomahawk and wooden feathers and tobacco sort of scattered out, and the bronc fogged it down the street with just the main chunk of dragging. A public-spirited buckboard team broke loose and joined, and an old lady did a sprint that I ain't seen beat yet. Some chickens was prospecting around out in the road, but they all got out from there, leaving a few feathers which settled down in the dust. The hoss goes around a corner, and the chunk he's dragging catches on the post of the rickety old barbed wire fence, busting the post and turning the hoss for a grunt knocker. Me and Bill is following, not running very straight, but pretty fast, considering the load we was carrying. We gets to the hoss before he gets up and gathers enough wind to run again, but we just gets the rope when he blows his stopper again and drags and wallers me and Bill all around him, being in a state of mind when he can't tell us from the cigar statue. The citizens begin to show their heads here and there, and finally comes the town marshal, him being the last to arrive at the trouble, as is customary. Well, Bill had to pay for that engine, and we always figured the price was pretty steep. But then, we wasn't art collectors, and I bet Bill is the first and only actual cowpuncher that ever bought a statue. That was the only engine uprising me and Bill was ever mixed up with, but it goes to show the terrible treachery of the engine character. A engine chief won't do to tie to. Doctors the Chimleys. There was a dance in a little town hall, and all was invited by the committee. Me and Bill didn't go together because I was some ways from there and didn't know whether I could go or not, and Bill, being sore, didn't wait for me and went with two fellers that had just come into the country. I got there when the dance was in full swing, and I see there was a sort of hostile feeling of some kind. It didn't take long to figure out that it was Bill and them other two Rannies was at the bottom of it. They were sure lit up and was making a lot of wisecracks and doing a lot of unnecessary jigging on the corners and a swigging gals by the weight that had all been swung just by the hands. They wanted me to have a drink, so I went out and took one or two just to be peaceful and friendly-like. But anyhow, it got me to where I could get the idea the way them other three boys was feeling. 'Twarn't no use to try and join up with them, for they had too much of a head start on me. But after that, it was sort of funny to watch. There was three men on the committee, and they was three waddies making the ruckus. So I figured, all things being free and equal, it's a good idea to give everybody concerned their head and let them buck. But them three hayshakers that was given the baye had another idea. The next thing I see is the old village marshal showing his badge to the boys and inviting them to vamoose. The other two Rannies were starting something, but Bill, he augured them out of it, and they all went out peaceful. Then the wife of one of them committee fellers says she is glad they went and that the folks that is ranching in the valley don't want ignorant cowhands coming in and messing up their social doings. And she wishes them as hadn't already went would go now. That sort of got under my hide, for I seen right now how most of them hayshakers felt about us cowfolks. Well, I went outside, and I heard one old feller say that his brother had sent him a sack of walnuts all the way from Missouri. And he took a couple of his friends over to his wagon and give them each a pocketful. And then they went to another wagon and fishes out a jug and all drinked and says to each other that the committee is sure enough three smart fellers and plumb gentlemen. They didn't see me at all, and I was glad they didn't, for it give me a chance to hit their jug. After a couple of drinks and a few minutes' thought, I catched a right pert idea. I got my hoss where I could grab him right quick, and then I went over back of the boarding house and got a big slop bucket off in the back porch. I dumped out what slop was in it and knocked the ice out of it and poured it plumb full of them walnuts. There was a lamp burning at the bottom of the town hall stairs, which I blowed out right now. The door was open, and they was a-doing the over-the-waves waltz. I gets close to the top of the stairs, and then I slings that bucket of walnuts all over the top steps and the top landing, and waved the old slop bucket by the bale and lets her go in amongst them for good measure, and yells like a wild man. And then I runs out and rides hell for leather toward the feed lot where Bill is feeding beef about 5 miles from there. When I gets to his shack, I don't find nobody, and I'm plumb anxious about Bill and them other two Rannies. And I also feel a little bit lonesome in case that committee or some of the town marshal's friends might come visiting out there. Of course, there ain't nothing they can prove, but there might be a heap of things they can do if there happens to be several of them. I see them two strange rannies has throwed their beds in the shack, so I crawls into Bill's hot roll, and I'm waked up sometime later when them three boys rides up. The next day, we fills up the feed sacks good and plenty and have just knocked off work early when the boss drives up in his buckboard. I ain't said nothing about the night before to the boys, and they ain't said nothing to me, for we each figures that the other feller has let go awful easy. The boss, he goes into the house, and pretty soon we all eases in to get the powders, whatever they're going to be. We all lights a smoke, and then he says, "Boys," he says, "they was sort of a ruckus to town last night. I ain't blaming nobody nor taking sides. Bill and these here two Texas boys done right by leaving the dance peaceful when they was asked to, although they hadn't ought to raise so much sand while they was there. But they never done right when they took the ladders from the alfalfa stacks and clumb up on the houses of all them committee fellers and the town marshal and plugged them chimneys full of gunny sacks and hoss blankets and such. Them men and their families come home long toward morning and tried to light a fire. They never knowed what was wrong, and they tore the stovepipes down and everything, and they had to put the women and kids to bed whilst they clumb up on the top of the house and uncorked the chimneys. One man froze his foot, and another one a ear, and Zeb Thompson cut his hand all to the dickens on the stovepipe." The other boys looked sad, but I can't help from busting out laughing right now. The boss lets me have my laugh out, and then he says to me, "Looky here, Shorty, you ain't got no call to laugh none. You went and took that sack of walnuts out from Lige Bascom's wagon and poured 'em in the boarding house slop bucket and slung 'em all over the top steps in the landing of the town hall. And when you slung the bucket into the crowd, you like to broke my sister-in-law's leg. The crowd all run out to get you, and they tromped on them walnuts and fell and slipped all over themselves, and quite a passel of 'em fell downstairs. The town marshal hit his tailbone on the steps and is just about paralyzed. Him and his woman had to stay at the neighbor's on account of his chimney was plugged and there wasn't no warm place to doctor him." The boss fills his pipe again and says, "Now, I figure to send you young sprouts to build a ground tank at a place over between the hogbacks, and I am sending them two old fellers out to feed the beef and watch the line camp. If these here Texas boys wants to do tankin' work, and I reckon they might jine in." That plan took us all as being agreeable, and the boss went out to go home. Bill looks out at the winder. "Look," he says, "the boss is took violent with a spell. He starts out, but one of them big, long Texans grabs him. 'Never mind,' says Tex. 'He ain't used to laughing so hard, and he's sort of doubled up like. It was right good of him to keep us all in these parts after the ruckus. Howsomever, I was watching that sister-in-law of his'n, and I reckon he wouldn't have felt so kind toward us if Shorty hadn't hit her in the leg with that there boarding house slop bucket.'" Bruskus Cadden was born in 1878 in Pennsylvania, and he died in Los Angeles in 1950, and he fit quite a bit into those 72 years of his time on earth. He was a cowboy, he was a bellhop, he was a writer, he wrote hundreds of poems and dozens of stories. He was a traveler. He traveled all around the USA for his work, and he traveled to Australia, rode in Australia. He traveled to Europe as a mule skinner in the U.S. Army and during World War I. He lied about his age to get into the Army. He was under average height. He called himself Shorty in his stories. He was an agile man. He did a backflip at age 60 at a Western Livestock Journal Company picnic. He was a tough and uncomplaining fellow. He was a rough string rider when he was young. He was dapper and handsome. He was a good dresser. He liked women, and they seemed to like him as well. He was a bit of a rip-roarer when he was young, but he became a family man, maybe late in life, about age 50. But he spent the rest of his life with his wife, Melly, and her children, who became his children. He was a partner with Catherine Field of the Field Ranch in Arizona. She made Western scenes, lie, and drawings to go with his poems, all the ones that they published in the Western Livestock Journal through the 30s and the 40s and the 50s. Bruce had a good sense of humor, and he had lots of friends. He could overlook imperfection in people, and maybe that's why he had so many friends. He also stood up for the lowly, and it's not just lowly amongst people, but he stood up for animals. He had a feeling he liked animals, and he knew their individuality, and a lot of that comes up in his writing. He loved music, and he loved dancing. He could play the mandolin. If I had to compare him to somebody that is better known, compare him as an artist and as a human being, I'd compare him to Charlie Russell, which I hope people won't think is far-fetched. Bruce was a talented artist, just like Charlie Russell. They both worked hard at their art all their lives, and they both loved to socialize and have a little liquid refreshment with their friends from time to time. Charlie Russell, I think everybody is aware, kept his balance despite his huge financial success. I think maybe it's because he didn't measure success in terms of that sort of money. Success was something else to him. And I think that's also true of Bruce. Bruce didn't make huge amounts of money, but he lived a comfortable life. He owned a house in Los Angeles. And I don't think the fact that he didn't have wealth really hurt him at all. I think he just soldiered right on, and he was, in his own terms, he was a success. And certainly in my eyes, he was a great success. On that personal side, I'd say I'm not from a ranching background by any stretch of the imagination. I came from the suburbs. I lived in the Boston suburbs when I was a kid and the Atlanta suburbs when I was a teenager. In the 1970s and 1980s, I got interested in cowboy music and cowboy poetry and was looking around for someone who would be able to teach me something. And I'm not really very good at listening to people who tell me things. And so I was lucky to find Bruce, because Bruce could tell me things. I loved what he had to say, the way he said it, and the kind of person that he seemed to be. And frankly, I could accept him as an authority, somebody I trusted, and somebody whose words I loved to listen to. And with that, I will stop and say, do the best thing you can to, if you want to know about Bruce, and just listen to or read his words.
And you can do that. Shorty's Yarns is still in print. We've been hearing a reading from Shorty's Yarns, the Western stories and poems of Bruce Kiscadden, with illustrations by Catherine Field, published by the Utah State University Press. They were read by the book's editor, Bill Seams. The music you're hearing is by that same Bill Seams with Ted Hensold from their album, The Educated Fellers. The Bookshelf is a production of Spokane Public Radio. Series producer and editor is Vern Windham. I'm occasional producer Nancy Roth.